Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Tammy Carver. Welcome to the John Carver Show. My husband has helped thousands of people around the world lead happier and more successful lives. Whether you're just beginning to lay your foundation or you've already built your life but need to shore up some weak spots, this show will help you.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
The text this morning, I'm titling Before the Big Time. Before the big time. Have you ever looked at famous people and forgotten what it may have been like, or maybe not have done the homework of the people that are famous now that once upon a time weren't so important and once at one time weren't so much out there in the public square? Mariah Carey, who's a musician and a singer, and one of her first jobs was sweeping hair in a salon. So, you know, you always don't start at the top is the point I'm trying to make here today. Jim Carrey, the actor, was a janitor once upon a time in his life. The Tonight Show host, or maybe the former Tonight Show host, Jay, worked at Mickey D's flipping burgers about 40-some years ago or so, long time ago. Jerry Seinfeld was a light bulb telemarketer. Just sat on the phone making phone calls all day long, selling things. Hugh Jackman, the actor that plays Wolverine with the things that come out of his knuckles, he was fired from his job for talking to too many people. Fired. These are just a few examples of some of the people that you don't know the backstory, but they didn't quit and give up. They kept going and perfected their art. Over in the book of Nehemiah in the Bible, in the Living Bible, it shares the prefix to a story that we've told many, many times in the church. Nehemiah 1 says, in December of the 20th year in the reign of King Artaxerxes in Persia, when I was at the palace of Shushan, one of my fellow Jews named Hananiah came to visit me with some men who had arrived from Judah. I took the opportunity to inquire about how things were going in Jerusalem. So he's in Persia. He's a captive. He's, a slave. And he was curious because he came from another area in the Jerusalem area trying to find out what was going on where his people used to live at the time. So it goes down to verse 2. How are they getting along? This paraphrase says, the Jews who returned to Jerusalem from their exile here. Well, they replied, things are good. The wall of Jerusalem is still torn down and the gates are burned. Now, it's obvious just from that sentence that city had been attacked and destroyed and not fixed up again. Verse 4, when I heard this, I sat down and cried. In fact, I refused to eat for several days, for I spent the time in prayer to the God of heaven. I'm in Nehemiah, which is in the Old Testament of the Bible, chapter 1, now verse 5. He says, O Lord God, I cried out, O God and awesome God, who keeps his promises and is so loving and kind to those who obey and love him, hear my prayer. Listen carefully to what I say. Look down and see me praying night and day for all the people of Israel. I confess that we have sinned against you. Yes, I and my people have committed the horrible sin of not obeying the commandments you gave us through your servant Moses. Oh, please remember what you told Moses, you said. I'm in Nehemiah chapter 1, now verse 8. If you sin, I will scatter you among the nations, Moses said. But if you return to me and obey my laws, even though you are exiled to the farthest corners of the universe, I will bring you back to Jerusalem. For Jerusalem is the place from which I have chosen you to live. So he goes on. Now, at the end of verse 10 or so, we see that Nehemiah was the cupbearer to the king. So Nehemiah was a servant to the king. So run down to Nehemiah chapter 2. Nehemiah chapter 2, starting in verse 1, in this paraphrase, it says, one day in April, 4 months later. Now, the beginning of Nehemiah was in a few months before that, right? Now, Nehemiah 2, in April, 4 months later, I was serving the king his wine, and he asked me, why so sad? You aren't sick, are you? You look like a man in deep trouble. So the king saw through the veneer of Nehemiah that something was wrong. For until then, the story says, I'd always been cheerful when I was with him. I was badly frightened, but I replied, sir, why shouldn't I be sad? For the city where my ancestors are buried is in ruins and the gates have been burned down. Let me just pause there for a minute and go back just a little bit. Sometimes, some of us, not all of us, can be intimidated not to speak up when the opportunity is given for us to speak up and tell us what's really on our hearts. Because sometimes we're intimidated by the image or the aura or the attitude of the group or the individual that we're trying to communicate with. So with a quick prayer to the God of Heaven, the story says, I replied, if it please your majesty, and if you look upon me with your royal favor, send me to Judah to rebuild the city of my fathers. So then the king replied. Now, if you stop and think about it, this is a pretty brazen act for a servant in that culture who had no rights at all. He was, in fact, a captive. Right. You know, he had no authority to speak of. He was property, if you will, in the sense of the Persian Empire taking these people from their home country and now have enslaved them over the years. Then for him to speak up to the, quote, owner of him was, I think, pretty substantial. So in verse 5, the king replied, with the queen alongside him, how long will you be gone and when will you return? So let's again pause. If Nehemiah, as the story says, was the cupbearer to the king, the cupbearer, Nehemiah, built trust with the king over time. So the king felt comfortable with asking him two questions. Well, more than two, but two questions here. How long will you be gone, and when are you going to come back? He built up a trust. The king and the cupbearer built up a relationship, and the way the relationship was built was Nehemiah chose to be a servant in the most elementary way. And that doesn't happen in 24 hours. That happens over a period of time. So it was agreed as time was set for his departure. So then we see that the long story, we're going to stop the story there, but we see at the end of the story that Nehemiah was allowed to not only take himself but others to this city, and over a relatively short period of time through a whole bunch of stuff, which we're not going to get into, to rebuild that city because he leveraged the trust that he had with the king through consistency, through servanthood, through not being afraid to speak up when the opportunity lent itself. If you stop and think about it, in your own life, how many times haven't you missed opportunities to speak up because you've been intimidated by the person to whom that you've been given an opportunity to speak up to, if that makes any sense? I'm not sure if I could repeat that again. But oftentimes we choose to ignore the opportunities or run from the opportunities because we're dealing with an image, we're dealing with an individual or a group of people that at least in our mind at the time are better than us. And I shared a few weeks ago that maybe they just got there before you. That's the only difference. They started ahead of you, right? Mm-hmm. Over in Luke chapter 16 in the New Testament, it says, if you're faithful in the little things, you'll be faithful in large things. But it doesn't stop there. It says, if you're dishonest in little things, then you're going to be dishonest in small things, you're going to be dishonest in big things. And or if you're going to be honest in small things, you're going to be honest in big things. So it seems to me, I go back, regress just a little bit, that the king saw the faithfulness in Nehemiah, that he could be trusted with just a cup. If he could be trusted with a cup, then he could probably be trusted with more than that. So if you stop and think about that a little more, trust in that culture was critical because the cupbearer could have poisoned what was in the cup.
That's right.
So the king chose Nehemiah because evidently Nehemiah had a reputation. So your reputation and my reputation can in fact put us before very important people. And that goal, when we're put in front of people, majority of the time is to serve them. And that trust and that relationship can then be a vessel, can be leveraged to impact a lot of other people's lives. Like in Nehemiah's case, that he went back and built a city and it impacted thousands of people. Rick Warren said, "You will never arrive at the state in life where you're too important to help with menial tasks. God will never exempt you from the mundane." He says it's a vital part of your character curriculum. Character curriculum. There's a story. I love stories because stories really paint an image of oftentimes what the Bible or what the theme is trying to say. When I was in high school, I took a typing class. By the way, this is a story. This is not my story because I didn't take typing in school. When I was in high school, I took a typing class. Today, I think it was the same class would be called keyboarding, since few people use typewriters these days. I took this class, and I hated it, the story says. Every day, we would do what I consider to be stupid exercises. For example, with our left hands, we would type A-Q-A-W-A-E-A-R-A-T, then S-Q-S-W-S-E-S-R-S-T. Then D Q D W D E D R D T, then F Q F W F E F R F T. Stupid exercises, she said. We would switch hands and do it a similar exercise with the right hand. This went on for weeks and even months, the story says. What did this little exercise have to do with typing? One day, as I was asking that question to myself in my mind, my teacher must have read my thoughts because she said, "Today, you're going to type sentences." But how, I thought, you haven't taught us how to type. You've just taught us these stupid exercises. She handed us our assignments for typing and left the room. And I didn't understand how, but I started pecking on that typewriter and words began to form. A miracle. I started typing quicker and sentences appeared than paragraphs I was typing. But how could this be? I learned this type by learning those little exercises. Then paragraphs. But how? She says, I learned it and learned it and learned it. And then she taught me how to type. The story says, being faithful in the little things, like A-Q-A-W-A-E-A-R-A-T, taught me how to do the big things, like typing 60 words a minute and finishing top in my class. So there's little stupid things that really, at least in your mind at the moment, don't mean diddly. In the scheme of things, make the world of difference if you don't quit doing the little, quote, menial things, the stupid exercises that in time mean an awful lot. In Proverbs chapter 14 in the Old Testament, it says, "In all there is profit, in all labor, rather, there is profit, but mere talk only leads to poverty. The crown of the wise are in their riches, but the folly of fools is foolishness. A truthful witness saves lives, but he who mutters lies is treacherous." I've learned that people who finally make it in life look at their struggles differently. Again, the people who make it in life look at their struggles differently. Many of them, maybe some of them deconstruct what's in their lives to break it down to smaller little hurdles that they can get over a lot easier. In other words, if you have a big mountain in your life, wouldn't it be easier to break the mountain down in smaller bites and you're able to accomplish a whole lot more, a whole lot faster? And then many of them, probably all of them, master faithfulness in the small things, which then enables them to make more of a difference in people's lives more often because they're being faithful in the smaller things, which gives them opportunities in the smaller things, which eventually lead to the bigger things. So consistency in the little things that oftentimes take a very long time, but if you don't leverage the faithfulness in the small things, then the big things, generally speaking, don't happen ever or as quickly. Does it make any sense? An author said, faithfulness isn't defined by a solitary act or achieved on one day. It's a long obedience in the same direction. Long obedience, consistency. Eugene Peterson writes, if we string together our days of faithfulness like small jewels of a golden chain, we'll arrive at the end of our earthly span to present the treasure to God in exchange for a crown. Man, it's so difficult sometimes to be faithful. It's so difficult sometimes to be consistent, because sometimes the last thing you want to be is consistent, when consistency oftentimes is difficult. I was at the gym on Saturday because I missed the gym the prior day. So a lady friend of mine, who happens to be older than my mom, or as old as my mom, just to clarify for those who know that I'm married and not the lady friend that you might think it is, she came over to me and touched my head. She goes, are you sick? I said, no. I said, why would you say that? She goes, you're here on a Saturday. I said, well, I missed yesterday, so I have to maintain in order to maintain. She goes, you're right, John. I'm glad you're here. The whole point is that it's easy for you to make an excuse not to do, because all these other things can pop up, and you know, we've talked about this before, that there's a book out called The Tyranny of the Urgent. The things that pop up, those little fires that you want to, you know, that you're tempted to put out when you're ignoring the major fire that you need to deal with every day, that you should be, your attention should be on those bigger things than many of those little smaller things. Dr. J.H. Jewett said that the believer or the smart person is to be an expert merchant in the commodity of time. The commodity of time. How many of us have wasted, don't raise your hands, how many of us have wasted hours, days, weeks, months, decades because we have not chosen to leverage time? We've wasted time. And by leveraging time, which suggests that you have to change your habits and what you're doing daily, weekly, monthly, which will then eventually turn out to be something bigger if you change what you're doing consistently. The great J. Oswald Sanders said, if we sincerely, before God, plan out our day along the lines suggested and carry out it to the best of our ability, we can and must leave it there. We should refuse to get into the bondage about what has not been done. I'll say that last sentence again. We should refuse to get into the bondage about what has not been done. How many of us in the past, not today, because we're all perfect or practically perfect in every way, that you look back and spend so much time fretting about what you didn't do, like yesterday and like last week and last month and last 5 years, instead of focusing on today and what you can do from here forward? Because what you're looking at yesterday, can't you, unless you're Doctor Who and you can go back in time, you know, I don't see how we can change the past. And it's so tempting for, I think, a lot of us to focus on the past versus what's focusing on right now. Over in Matthew chapter 25, it tells a story about this boss. And I'll just start, and I'll kind of skip around a bit. But in verse 21 of Matthew 25, one paraphrase says, the master or the boss was full of praise, and he says, well done, my good and faithful servant. You've been faithful in handling this small amount, and now I'll give you more responsibilities. But it didn't start there. The story ended there, or almost ended there. It didn't start there. If you go up to Matthew 25, verse 14, this paraphrase says, again, the kingdom of heaven can be illustrated by the story of a man going into another part of the world, and He called together his servants and loaned them money to invest for him while he was gone. Let me just pause there a minute. That as I see it, our time is loaned to us. Are we getting a good return on our time? Or are we wasting time? I've had clients over the years who had money invested in stuff that they lost money year after year after year. And I tell them, you know, I can help you do this and do this and move it here where you won't ever, 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 ever lose a dime. And they say, but what if? But for the last 5 years, you've lost $15,000, $25,000, $30,000. But they're not looking at what could be. They're afraid to make that move. Again, Matthew 25. Now, verse number 15. So this guy was going away for an extended period of time. He gave one guy the equivalent of $5,000. He gave another guy about $2,000. Another guy $1,000. Divided up. He says he divided it up into how they were able to leverage their skills. Okay. So. The next verse says, the man receiving the $5,000 began immediately to buy and sell with it and earned another $5,000. So the man with the $2,000 went right to work and earned another $2,000. So this guy's doing really well. He picked these guys right, and these guys hustled from the very first day. But the man, verse 18, but the man who received $1,000 dug a hole in the ground and hid the money for safekeeping. I think we all know people like that. We've had relatives who literally buried their money in the backyard. Literally in the backyard. And then forgot where in the backyard because of time. No joke. Verse 19. After a long time, the master returned from his trip and called to them to give an account on their money. I think, I can't really declare when and where, but I think that at some point in our lives, we're going to be responsible to look back and give an account of where we've wasted our time and where we've maximized our time. So in verse 21, let me back up to 19. After a long time, the master returned from the trip. The guy who gave him $5,000, he brought him $10,000. And the guy who brought him $2,000, he doubled that. But down in verse 24, it says, then the man with the $1,000, he came and said, sir, I knew you were a hard man. And I was afraid you would rob me of what I earned, so I hid your money in the earth, and here it is. This paraphrase says. But then the master responded in a very interesting way. The paraphrase says, wicked man, you lazy slave, since you knew I would demand your profit, you should at least have put your money in the bank, and I could have gotten some interest out of it. So he said, verse 28, take the money from this man and give it to the man with the $10,000. For the man who uses well what he is given shall be given more, and he shall have abundance. But from the man who is unfaithful, even what little responsibility he has is taken from him. So let me just, again, hit the brakes on this. That if I use this story as a life example, why would God bless us abundantly? Why would God bless me? Why would God bless you abundantly if we don't leverage what we have now? If we don't maximize it? If we don't work it until there's nothing else to work with? Does that make any sense? So we look at the $1,000 in this example and think, what can we possibly do with just $1,000? Well, you can double it. You can triple it. You can quadruple it if you worked it properly. But so many times we think that because that maybe our talents aren't so much or we don't have $1 million in the bank that we can't do X, Y, or Z, that must mean that you can't get something done. Well, I would call that a bunch of hooey in polite terms. That you can leverage much, much more if you realize what you have and then work that until. You work that until. Chris Gardner, who's very rich right now, but wasn't always rich. In fact, for a period of time, he was homeless. He said in one of his books, he said the future was uncertain. Again, the future was uncertain, absolutely, and there were many hurdles twists and turns to come. But as long as I kept moving forward, one foot in front of the other, the voices of fear and shame, the messages of those who wanted me to believe that I wasn't good enough would soon be stilled. And the fact that Chris Gardner didn't give up enabled him to, after much persistence, by the way, enabled him to not only create a great lifestyle for himself, but a whole lot of other people as well. Michael Hyatt said one time, I would say that sometimes the most radical thing that you can do with your life is simply be faithful. I'll say it again. I would say sometimes that the most radical thing you can do with your life is to simply be faithful. Do you know, I think if you take a room of people or a city of people, the number of people that can truly say in the mirror that I've been faithful is very, very few. Because the minority of people, the few people, are the faithful, not the majority.
That's right.
Because the majority, frankly, are not faithful. They hit, skip, and miss. They stop and start. They're not steady at anything. So when you stop and start, nothing gets really accomplished because it takes so long to get going again. And then by the time you get going again, you get tired. It's a whole lot easier to keep going than to stop and start, I think, right? He said, you heard that right. By consistently doing the same thing every single day, you might be more radical than you think. I know that he says it doesn't sound very sexy, but it's the stuff that gives weight to significant social change. So it seems, at least through these two examples, Chris Gardner and Michael Hyatt, let alone what I just shared in the last 20 minutes or half hour, that consistency matters. Faithfulness matters. Stopping and starting really doesn't. If you go back again to the Old Testament story in Nehemiah, when you get into the deep part of the story, Nehemiah was being asked by others to stop and start, specifically to stop. He was on a roll. Some people came by and said, why don't you stop? Let's kind of hang out, have a beer or have something to drink or go to Applebee's or something. But in reality, they were going to kill him to have him stop permanently, to not rebuild, to not be consistent. I wonder how many people in your life and my life aren't necessarily there to kill you, obviously, but certainly there to distract you from what you're trying to get done. I've shared this in the past, but one of the most powerful words that's in the English language is no. It's okay to say no. It's okay. For years and years, it was hard for me to say no. But when you're in the middle, of a flow, the last thing you want to do is what? Is to break the flow, right? Chuck Swindoll said that life is more about the mundane than the magnificent. Because faithfulness oftentimes is mundane. The same thing, day in, day out. In fact, more of the same thing, day in and day out. But what happens when a miner, M-I-N-E-E-R, I think, digs looking for gold? If you go 3 feet or 6 feet or 100 feet into a mountain and you don't see any gold, when you know gold's in there, what do? Stop? No, you keep digging until. That's the beauty of consistency, that the people who give up and quit never hit the gold. They're the ones who never reach it. They're the ones who never achieve the stuff, that the ones who, through all the blood, sweat, and tears, they keep going until they reach the gold. I would hope that you and I are the ones who will continue to do it. John Harbaugh, one of the coach, he said, do whatever you can to help others be their best. Do whatever you can to help others be their best. Not for where it takes you, but rather where it takes the organization. So if everybody on the team, of any team, is leveraging faithfulness in their own life, I mean, let's say not even everybody, let's say more than half of the people in an organization, office, church, home, is being steady and consistent and faithful, then things are going to move a whole lot faster and stuff's going to get a lot more done a lot faster because they're faithful. Sometimes it's tempting to forget that being steady is giving really all that you have, but not more than you have. Again, giving all you have, but not more than you have. Because in the middle of the battle, you think that you can't give another hour. You can't give another minute. You can't give another ounce of energy. When in fact, you stop and think about it, I know you've gone through it before, like I have, that you're shocked that you had more in you than you thought you did. So in fact, when you're tempted to stop, there's more in there. There's more in that mayonnaise jar than you think. You got to scrape a bit more, but there's more mayo in that jar, right?
Yeah.
Working with determination and not waiting for your ship, S-H-I-P, to come in. You swim out to your ship, and you swim and swim and swim until you reach it. And quitting when the job's done, not when you're tired. That's a big one.
Yeah.
I mean, there's times when I just want to be done. But Mom and I are a lot alike in this way, that when we're in the middle of a project, we don't like stopping until it's done, which she got that from her dad. So it's in the genes, I think, that once we start something and I'm on a roll, please don't stop. So that's sometimes when people call, like my father, he'll call, how you doing? It's like, and you don't want to offend your father. I mean, you don't want to hurt his feelings because, you know, but when you're on a roll, any interruption can kind of, when you're on, you know, watch this guy walk across the tightrope on the Grand Canyon, right? I forgot his name already, but he's walking on this tightrope, and his focus to get across to the other side must be what? On his lunch he's going to get on the other end? No. His attention must be on the high wire. If not, I mean, he can't have ADD. There's no way. He can't be distracted by the helicopter who's videoing him doing this, and he can't be distracted about cameras and lights and millions of people watching, hoping he does and or doesn't fall. You know what I'm saying? He can't be distracted by that. A president of the United States, years and many years ago, 50, no, probably 80 years ago, he said, nothing in this world takes the place of persistence. He says, talent won't. Nothing is more important or common, he says, than unsuccessful people with talent. Mm-hmm. You've met people who passed away with gobs of talent in them that hasn't been developed, right?
Oh, yeah.
He says, genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb, the quote says. Persistence and determination alone are omnipotent, the story says, or the quote says. The slogan, press on, has resolved and always will solve the problems of the human race. Persistence. So what's the theme of today? Is that the people who make it, the folks who have made it, unless your last name is Trump or Rockefeller or some other famous person out there, you weren't born at the top of the mountain, or they weren't born at the top of the mountain. They climbed night and day to the top of the mountain. There's a young lady I know who a couple years ago was trying to catch a fish. We were blessed with a trip to Florida, and she hadn't fished in a while, and she's fishing and casting the thing and trying to catch a fish and would not catch a fish. So big brother came by to try to help, because big brother's was trained by one of the best people that knew how to fish, and she still couldn't catch a fish. It was getting dark. I said, well, why don't we go on back to the room and we'll try this another time. She looks at me, of course, I got the camera in my video camera in my hand. She goes, I'm not a giver upper. And that quote, by the way, is going around the world, you know, since then, that, you know, she's not a giver upper. And shortly thereafter, I'd say 20 minutes, half hour after that, she caught a fish. Thank goodness Tim was there to encourage her and to help train her as well. Author Irving Stone has spent a lifetime studying greatness, he says, with a lot of biographies of Michelangelo and Vincent van Gogh and Sigmund Freud and others. Stone was once asked if he had found a thread that runs through the lives of these incredible people. He said, I write about people who sometime in their life have a vision or a dream of something that should be accomplished, and they go to work. Then they're beaten over the head, knocked down, vilified for years, and they get nowhere. Anybody you know that have had those issues? But every time they're knocked down, they stand up. I'll say it again. But every time they get knocked down, they stand up. You cannot destroy these people, the author says. And at the end of their lives, they've accomplished some modest part of what they set out to do. I'll say it again. The few stand back up. The majority stay down. So that would suggest mathematically, and I'm not a math genius by any stretch, that the few succeed much farther than the great number of people, because the fewer keep getting back up again. Maybe they're not smart enough to stay down. I don't know. But they keep getting back up again and getting back up again. So each time you get back up again and take a step forward, guess where you are? You're then closer. So then those of us who stay down, when we're down, we're not taking any steps forward at all because we're down. We choose to stay down. So the point is here that all of us have a choice to stay down or to keep moving forward. We know story after story about people throughout history who have decided that enough was enough, that their actions over a period of maybe weeks, months, or years changed cultures, changed societies. People like Rosa Parks is one example. And she, you know, I think I read somewhere that she said her feet were just tired. She was just tired, and she wasn't going to move. Well, her the story about the bus, for those who don't know, it's in the history books. I'm not going to go through the long story of it, but she was on a bus, and in that culture, you know, the white people had the first choice of the front seats in the bus. Well, the black people were, in that culture, forced to sit in the back of the bus. Well, she happened to be toward the front of the bus because her feet were tired, and some white guy comes up and says, "You got to move," and she's like, "I'm not moving." Well, she got arrested, got a whole lot of trouble. And well, that one act was a catalyst that changed some years later society. So your tenacity of not moving when somebody says you need to move, if it's done for the right purposes and the right reasons here, can literally change a culture for the better. So the big picture here is don't think that your small act of being steady, of doing the right thing consistently, doesn't matter, because it really does over time. A guy named Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a pastor in Germany during World War II, and he was got in a lot of trouble for speaking his mind about what was wrong in that culture of the time. But he said, we must be ready to allow ourselves to be interrupted by God. That really grabbed me. We must allow ourselves to be interrupted by God. We must not assume that our schedule is our own to manage. But allow it to be arranged by God. God will constantly crossing our paths and counseling our plans and sending us people with claims and petitions and requests. But that first part really got, we must be always allowing God to interrupt our lives. So the point is there's a ton of hard work and pain before big time. A ton. So, I mean, years, maybe decades. But that time of faithfulness must be leveraged, is how I started here. Because if it's not leveraged, then your faithfulness is going to be faithful. It's going to be rewarded. But you should use that faithfulness as a stepping stone and not a plateau. Over in the Old Testament, in the book of Esther, we share the story, and there's so many parts of the story and time's getting away from us quickly. But Esther was a piece of property. Mm-hmm. Esther was a lady who, in that culture, kings had multiple girlfriends, and I'll be polite, and his choice of wives, and I use that term in plural. So it wasn't like a love relationship. They fell in love with the Dairy Queen, and you know, his eyes met her eyes, and that's not really the way that culture was. She was a piece of property in his eyes, in their eyes, the king's eyes, and if he liked what he saw, then she was to become his wife. Well, this king was already married to Vashti, and Vashti had a little attitude. I don't know if she was having a bad day or what, but the king got bent out of shape with Vashti, his queen, and he said, "Be gone with you," and she's gone. Well, there came a time when in Esther chapter 2 that some situations happened, and uncle got involved, and the king saw Esther, and Esther saw the king, and they eventually, you know, became married. And then there was word that one of the king's men were going to have the Jewish culture wiped out. The whole crew. I mean, I don't know how many people. It was certainly thousands. Could have been more than thousands. But Esther was Jewish, and the uncle was Jewish, and the guy who was going to get everybody killed was not, obviously. So long story short, that the uncle proceeded to encourage Esther that now you're the queen. Now you're right in the presence of the king many days, that you have an opportunity. Well, Esther came back and said, "Look, in this culture, unless the king invites you in, you know," and she, remember, she had just within a very short amount of time saw Vashti being, you know, kicked out because of Vashti's lack of respect for the king. So Esther's like, you know, I'm not, I like it now. You know, they do my nails and they do my hair now and everything's great. I'm not going to mess this up. Plus, too, he doesn't know that I'm Jewish. So if he would have known I was Jewish, you know, he probably wouldn't have married me. So all these thoughts are going through her head. So uncle comes up and says that, "Did you ever think that," and I'll paraphrase this, that maybe, just maybe, that you were born, the King James says something to the effect of, "For such a time as this." For such a time as this. So Esther, over a period of time, was challenged to leverage not only her heritage, but her faithfulness and her, for the lack of a better way to say it, her location to the influencer. Mm-hmm. Her location to the influencer. Sometimes it's really scary to leverage your location to the influencer. Sometimes you're challenged to speak up when every cell in your body is yelling at you to shut up. When you could be that catalyst in that person's life to change their lives in a way, and by the way, not only your life, but in Esther's case, thousands of people's lives. Well, the story kind of sort of ends when the guy that was going to have all these people killed, so I'm not going to get into the nuts and bolts of it, but anyway, he ended up getting the short end of the stick. Mm-hmm. Pun intended, if you know the story. Mm-hmm. He lost in a big way because through the courage and through the encouragement of uncle, her uncle, mm-hmm, which was in essence her adoptive dad, mm-hmm, prompted her to step up, and her heart was probably jumping out of her chest the whole time. But she chose to step up and speak up for people that she didn't even know. She knew of them, but she didn't know them personally because there were so many of them. So oftentimes for you and I to step up, uncle gave Esther a huge why. And oftentimes the why gets people moving in the right direction. Remember I told you I started working out because because bees chased me. Right, I couldn't outrun the bees, so that was my why. So next time I get chased by bees or bears, then I'm going to be able to outrun them both. Make any sense? So again, before the big time comes, there's trouble, there's terror, and there's temptation not to fight for people. There's temptation not to fight for other people. So I leave you with the words of, again, Chris Gardner, who also said, "Others may question your credentials, your papers, your degrees even. Others may look for all kinds of ways to diminish your worth. But what is inside you, no one can take from you or tarnish." Mm-hmm. this is your worth, who you really are, your degree that can go with you wherever you go, that you can bring with you the moment you come into a room that can't be manipulated or shaken. Without that sense of self, he says, no amount of paper, no pedigree, and no credentials can make you legit. No matter what, you have to feel legit inside first. So before the big time, all the stuff I just shared needs to be at least in your thinking, that consistency and leveraging that consistency can make all the difference in the world. I'm so fired up about my fourth book that came out. It's called Build Your Foundation, 68 Building Blocks for a Successful and Rewarding Life. I've compressed about 25 years of knowledge, experience, and learning from a lot of people to help you in your life. You can get a copy of it over at TremendousLifeBooks.com. Again, TremendousLifeBooks.com. Here's some more information about it. For the last 25 years, I've visited with thousands of people in their homes. Many of these people I've met with have no goals, no dreams, no ambitions, and no roadmap for their life. I've seen so many people sitting on their front porches watching life go by. In 2006, my wife and I started building our home with bedrooms for each of our six kids. I always made sure that the foundation of our home was solid. I didn't want to take any chances with the lives of my family. So it is with life. My book, Build Your Foundation, 68 Building Blocks of a Successful, Rewarding Life, is jammed full of ideas that can help you today. My book is a collection of ideas and short stories really designed to help you turn your life around and to help impact the people that you care about and that you love so much. Whether you're just beginning to lay your foundation or you've already built your life but need to shore up some weak spots, Build Your Foundation will help you fortify yourself for a lifetime of success and to give you the courage to go for your dreams in life. Don't miss out on what you can accomplish. You can scale any height and achieve any goal. This book will help you get there. I have a passion to help millions of people change their lives. This book is easy to read, has short chapters, and can help you right now and change your life today. I believe in you. Thank you so much for listening to the John Carver Show. If you want more information about me, just simply go to my website, www.johnwcarver.com. Again, thanks so much for listening to the show today, and remember, I believe in you.
Thank you for listening to the John Carver Show. Please tune in again right here Monday through Friday for more insights and opinions on how you can reach your goals and dreams in life.